Welcome to HR Unpacked, a podcast about HR workplace issues, where we analyse and then discuss the latest developments in HR and employment law that impact both employers and employees. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you, Jonathan. Great to be here as always. So welcome to our podcast today, where we're going to be talking about neurodiversity, which affects apparently 15 to 20% of our population. And the National Autistic Society do say that around 45% of people who are neurodiverse have potentially struggled or lost their jobs because of the issue and condition and workplace matters. And litigation is on the increase in this area. So we're really, really pleased to have Kaylee Frost, Head of Clinical Support from Health Assured, with us today, who's going to help us navigate this really important and complex issue. So thank you, Kaylee. Great to have you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for having me.
It's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. So I think the best place to start really is, can you explain to us what neurodiversity is in the best way possible for the audience?
No problem at all. So neurodiversity is a concept more than anything. It is a way of looking at individuals' changes or differences in their thought patterns, their behaviours, their perception. And neurodiversity is often referred to as the condition or the challenge, but it's actually the umbrella term.
Okay.
And like you say, nearly 20% of people are said to have had or have a neurodiversity or are neurodivergent. So that means actually it could be one of a dozen different things. There are different conditions that individuals are born with or develop as they go through their formative years. So everything, I mean, the more common ones, ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, ADD, which is attention deficit disorder, dyslexia, dyspraxia, Tourette's, but epilepsy is also considered a neurodiversity as well.
And I didn't know that.
Did you? To be fair, it is. I mean, everyone's heard of epilepsy, but they don't class it as under the neurodiversity, you know, umbrella. Again, so they're all things that individuals have as it's a physical condition that impacts the brain, essentially. The misconceptions as well is that if someone is neurodivergent, they have a mental health condition, or that is a mental health issue, being neurodivergent. But it's absolutely not the case. A lot of individuals may be neurodivergent, may be suspecting of a diagnosis, may have a formal diagnosis, and not really experience any challenges with their mental health either. So yeah, in a nutshell, it is an umbrella term. It's a concept looking at the way and understanding the way people's brains work, slightly different to someone that's neurotypical, so to speak.
It feels like, well, it's probably a definite, really. It's getting spoken about a lot more.
Is that
because there is obviously more awareness of it and more people getting diagnosed? What is the source of that?
There's a number of different factors, and it's something that I've seen a huge rise in just in my role. So looking after a counselling helpline, looking after psychological services and occupational health, we're seeing an influx in people going, an employee states that they may have a neurodiversity. They might be going for an ADHD assessment or something like that. Help us. You must help us. And actually, you need to kind of roll it back and actually look at what is impacting the individual, but move on to that in a moment. But a lot of this is coming from a wider understanding and education piece of what constitutes a different neurodiversity. In my opinion, huge social movement. I'm a very avid TikToker. I don't actually do videos myself, but spend a lot of time doom scrolling, some people might say. And every other video is, you know, I'm an ADHD girly and here's my common traits and here's how I navigate, you know, being, you know, someone that's on the autism spectrum and so on. So every other video feels like it's something like that. So more and more people are having access to this influential type of content. But alongside that as well, there's been more, not enough, but more investment into understanding different neurodiversities, bringing awareness to them. It's almost feeling destigmatized within communities of individuals who have a neurodiversity or suspect they are, because of all this content and media around that. Sometimes it does feel like a circus train at some points. I don't know if you guys ever kind of see that. Everything is...
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly, I've certainly come across that in the conversations we're having with clients as well and the prevalence of it.
Yeah. There's, as a result of that, it's kind of what came first, chicken or the egg?
Yeah.
But there are more practitioners, psychiatrists, psychologists, and doctors and physicians in general that have an enhanced understanding of the criteria to assess individuals.
Yeah.
I think back to when I was probably at primary school, not even secondary school, and ADHD was heard of. It was spoken about then, but it was always the naughty kid in the class that throws the chair across the room or something like that. It really negative connotations. And the word neurodiversity wasn't even a thing then. Everyone just kind of knew ADHD, maybe epilepsy, and a little bit around autism as well. But now there's just a huge amount of clinical research happening, loads and loads of publications. And it's something I feel more exposed to as well, because my counsellors, are always coming forward with new things that they've learned in their academic studies, but also on placements as well. So it's becoming a very commonplace subject. But I'm very lucky in the clinical world. We're almost a little bit ahead. But then in your general, you know, all other organisations, workplaces, schools and so on, don't really seem to... They're on, almost everyone's on the back foot because they don't have that immediate insight into criteria, assessments, diagnosis, and so on.
Yeah, it's very like methodical, that, isn't it? You can diagnose, it's structured, but to navigate that as an employer is a lot more challenging.
I mean, sometimes if I take my clinical hat off and then putting my manager hat on, even then I forget everything that I've been reading and learning throughout the clinical studies, and think, oh my goodness, this individual has just disclosed X, Y, Z. What do I need to do again? But there's no reinventing the wheel with this either. And it's not something that employers need to be scared of, or even from a personal level, you know, if you've got loved ones, friends and so on, or colleagues, you know, in the workplace that are coming to you and disclosing a suspected diagnosis or that they have got one, it's not a miracle solution that's needed. It's collaborative working, open conversations and discussions. So whilst many people do feel on the back foot because they're not in the centre of these clinical research and clinical interventions, doesn't mean that they're light years behind or have loads to catch up on. A little bit of self-education will go a long way.
Yeah, okay.
Kate mentioned about the population of people, of neurodiverse people who don't go into work. For the ones that have been diagnosed or believe that they are neurodiverse, what challenges do they face in the workplace?
Well, it would depend what neurodiversity they may have or suspect that they have. Sometimes people can have a combination. Some people might have ADHD, autism, and potentially dyslexia. You know, they could have 3, 4, 5, 6 of these. So dependent on which condition, or I hate using the word disorder because it has a real negative connotation to it, and it puts them individuals on the back foot themselves. But so someone might be overstimulated by their surroundings, their working environment. A huge thing from a workplace is open office environments for multiple different neurodivergent individuals, dependent on which condition they associate themselves with. That can be a really overwhelming and overstimulating environment. It could be things like timeliness, time management. Some individuals experience things like time freezes and time blockers. Very common with individuals that have ADHD, they might experience time go by in the blink of an eye, or it might just completely slow down altogether for them. So they lose that awareness.
I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, interesting concept.
So with that, people may struggle to get to work on time.
Right.
And maybe they don't realise, or they haven't for a number of years understood what it is. It isn't just laziness, which is what it is often associated with. You can't get yourself out of bed in the morning, you're not leaving, you know, your home on time. Actually, they are experiencing a neurological change that is making time not work in the same way that it would for someone that's neurotypical. So for years, they've probably been penalised for lateness, been put on XYZ HR procedures. So yeah, time management.
Can I ask a question on that though?
Yeah, yeah.
How does an employer decide whether to accept that as an explanation or still persist with those HR policies? Because that's so difficult for your everyday employer who's trying to survive and grow and keep the head above water in many cases for SMEs. Any advice around that?
In terms of, so it's how your conversations, what your relationship with that employee is like.
Yeah.
If your employee is citing that as the reason why, as they would with any other condition they might have, they would be comfortable backing that up, you know, with medical evidence.
Yeah.
Maybe they had the formal diagnosis, so they'll bring all the documentation with that. And actually, what a reasonable adjustment might be for that is if their common pattern is that they're getting in at 20 past nine every day, rather than, you know, 5 to 9 to start the 9 o'clock shift, doing a shift slide, you know, a half nine till a half five, for example. I'm just thinking of my shifts like that. But if they are citing that, they need to be able to back that up as well, as you would with any other condition that you've got. There does need to be probably reviewing your triggers, lateness triggers as well. But constant communication and collaboration needs to be really key. It is super difficult, you know, if someone is a train driver and they're expected to be there for the X o'clock train departing platform 9, you know, that's going to be more difficult. And within that, you know, if that's something that is business critical, then I think it's suitable and appropriate to go down certain HR you know, protocols and procedures if it is absolutely crucial to their role.
Context dependent, isn't
exactly, it? Exactly. I'm thinking, you know, there was someone in my team that would be a little more easier to accommodate on, say, one of my admin teams. But if it was one of my nurses that have pre-scheduled appointments 4 weeks in advance, that might not be suitable. But a shift slide, those types of things, if it's common that it's always going to be the same 15, 20 minutes a day, they do need to be looking at other strategies themselves, though. And if they are going down some primary care routes, they can get support from their care team that will be going, you know, taking through the assessment processes, but also getting some ideas. It's not one size fits all either. Speaking to someone like a counsellor very briefly can give some other hints and tips based on the type of person that they are and how else they, you know, think about certain situations.
Do you monitor the uptake in employers requesting neurodiverse diagnosis? Have you noticed that?
Yeah, and the actual diagnostic piece we don't provide. We provide almost the preparation, signpost and guidance on what that process looks like, and then almost holding support, and then the aftermath almost. You know, that diagnosis piece needs to be done by a psychiatrist, and the waiting lists are, in some instances, excruciating.
Yeah.
There was one local authority, and I was told that at present the waiting list was something like 34 years because they did not have the right psychiatrist in that area. That would chop and change wherever you are, wherever the funding is in certain areas.
Yeah.
You can get it done quite quickly on a private basis. And it's something that we're looking at, but it's so incredibly specialist. And it's almost, you know, the demand for formal diagnosis is increasing, but the people trained to do it isn't
are we matching. Seeing that being addressed?
Alternatives are often looked at, but again, it needs to be a psychiatrist that has gone through years of additional training to be able to do that. And with the criteria constantly widening and expanding, it is quite difficult to match the demand of people looking for that diagnosis. But saying that diagnosis, that isn't the be-all and end-all. It feels like a lot of people want that label, almost, you know, that. And for some people, that's really needed, and they've been searching for an answer as to why they are a certain way their whole life. And that's okay. But we are seeing a rise in individuals looking for that, not necessarily for not valid reasons, but it doesn't feel as genuine because people are looking for, you know, well, if I've got ADHD, I can get XYZ, work from home, flexible hours. And it doesn't seem genuine when there's a lot of people that genuinely are struggling.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I mean, obviously, the way you talk about it is incredibly complex. I mean, how does an employer navigate this?
Oh, gosh, yeah. So, it would depend which condition, challenge that someone is having.
Yeah.
The first thing that they should always be doing, anything regarding someone that doesn't fit the mold or is neurotypical, you have to have created that open, approachable workplace. You know, is transparency, it's a safe environment. If you're someone that is prone to shutting conversations down, or you're very obviously uncomfortable yourself in having these conversations, you're never going to be able to invite that individual to come and share their challenges or their worries, concerns about what they may or may not be, you know, potentially diagnosed with. So that is really important. Addressing things like neurodiversity approaches and wellbeing policies is something that we can support on as well. And we have done a number of times. But again, it's that neurodiversity policy could end up being 70 pages long once you address each individual neurodiversity. And it's not one size fits all. People that are neurodivergent, it's a spectrum.
Yeah.
So on that, there are different severities. You could have someone that is more severe on the autistic spectrum, and someone that is less severe, and they will have different needs and requirements.
Mm.
So open conversations, understanding, letting that person speak and understanding what it is they're struggling with. Be used to having things like wellness action plan conversation, very, you know, very bog standard templates that you can get, but that helps you if you're not comfortable having difficult conversations about someone's challenges in this way. Self-education in the workplace. I do think it should be mandatory for leaders of some kind to even have a basic 101 understanding of the more common neurodiversities and how they exhibit themselves in the workplace, and how they can be detrimental to individuals, but also how they can be a really great thing for those individuals. Because we focus a lot here on the negativity, but individuals that are neurodivergent are a huge asset in your workplace. Super analytical.
Mm.
If you give them a project to deep dive into, they are going to do it, and they are going to do it exceptionally.
Yeah.
And you've got to work on harnessing the huge positives in having a neurodivergent.
Yeah, there's so many, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely amazing. And if you've got that such a diverse workforce, you are going to be unstoppable because you've got all these different skill sets. Going back to a couple of other tips, I would look at a workplace needs assessment as well. Yeah. Having someone that is appropriately trained externally, look at the job role, look at how that individual performs it and the surrounding environment, you know, the actual workplace itself. Mm. And they can give some recommendations. Some, you know, if you really don't know where to start, I would look at a workplace needs assessment. I would look at the job role and the tasks compared to their skill set. If it is someone that is struggling with, say, time management and they're appointment based, you need to look at making some adjustments in there with the resources that you've got. You know, have you got an adequate calendar system, appointment system that puts notifications, reminders and things like that? There's a huge, I mean, the list is endless for recommendations. Yeah. These are just kind of top tips as well, but you can drill down. We've got loads of resources ourselves, but you can just literally type into Google, how do I support someone with ADHD in the workplace? ADHD UK is amazing. I use that all the time. I help our nurses, you know, make certain recommendations with that, and have used it and applied it myself. And again, it's all what's within what you're able to do as a business. If one of the workplace recommendations is this person needs to work at home in isolation because their condition is too at risk of being overstimulated because of their working environment, but they work as a checkout assistant, that's obviously not, you can't apply
well,
that.
It's not an adjustment you can make. It's not a reasonable adjustment.
Yeah, exactly. And as long as you can say comfortably, you know, this does or does not fit with our business model and how we operate and provide our whatever service or, you know, whatever it might be, then that's okay as long as you can evidence that, as with any kind of adjustment.
Yeah.
The university has what I call disability passports. So the staff member can be assessed, and it's literally like a passport that they have, which is their reasonable adjustment plan. And it outlines what their issues are and what the plan is to support them. And then they can share that if they want to share it with anybody. So some of the staff members email or come and speak to whoever they work with and say, this is my disability passport. This is how I behave for whatever reason. This is the support. And this is how I want to interact. So they kind of dictate. So rather than saying, I'm going to change the workplace for you, the individual is changing everything around them. So it's the other way around. So it gives them some ownership and some that power and control over it as well.
That is brilliant. I think where I struggle, that's brilliant in an establishment of this size, with your ability to do that, etc. The challenges I see, and I don't know if we've got to an answer for this for both the employee and the employer respectively, is a garage or a chippy or a corner shop. And I think there's still such a lack of understanding of how to navigate that in these organisations where, and to the detriment of the employee and the employer, you know, where they just don't, they can't suss it out. And I think that is just that constant awareness piece. I can't think of anything else that can help with that.
A lot of self-education needed. You know what? Even still yesterday when I was reviewing my notes for today, I had to remind myself what dysgraphia is, which is a neurodiversity where someone is unable to distinguish or differentiate the written word. So it's slightly different to dyslexia. You know, it's so nuanced with that. If you think there's 12 plus and more kind of coming out on a regular basis, you have to self-inform and self-educate as well. It's like 6-7 years ago, people being terrified of talking about anxiety, depression in the workplace. God, you know, this individual is at risk. And actually, you know, there is no risk there. You need to just be able to talk about it and know what practices there are. But everyone has some kind of mental health in the workplace training or e-learning or something of that nature, you know, now. But
does that cover everything though? Because we mentioned in previous podcasts about, in theory, we call it the empty shell syndrome, whereby you have a policy and there's nothing underneath it. And we've talked about it before. So you have all these policies, but they're not effective.
Well, this is it. So everyone has that tick box of doing some kind of, I've done a mental health awareness of managers or mental health first aid, but they never actually applied it or really listened to how it should or implemented it and integrated it into the workplace. But everyone has some kind of understanding of how anxiety might exhibit itself, I guess, within an individual, or depression. But no, I bet you know, the less than 1 out of 10 could tell you how dysgraphia, you know, for example, or dyscalculia or dyspraxia could exhibit itself, not just in the workplace, but at all, you know, no one has enough understanding of this. So it really needs to be constant re-education, awareness sessions. We do guides. There's guides left, right and centre, but they need to be used and that needs to be mandated and enforced in the workplace. But at the same time, the individuals themselves don't have enough understanding. They see, you know, they may see a couple of things that are feeling like a hindrance to them, or they've spotted something online, thinking that sounds like me, but not looked into it enough about what that means for them and what they need in return. They also need to stop and think.
Just on that, and I know you're not a psychologist, so forgive me if you can't answer this question, but this sometimes when you describe that one of these particular kind of named neurodivergent titles as such, for want of a better phrase, some of the qualities you describe, I think I'm like that.
Oh yeah, you know, I do as well.
As humans, are we all on this kind of spectrum at some point of it? How does that work? And forgive me if you can't answer that question.
No, it's fine. I mean, I suspect that as well. The 1 in 5, the 20% of individuals that are neurodivergent, that's when you're going through the formal diagnosis, you know, and you get in that. That's, I think, everyone is at some level, even incredibly mildly, on that that spectrum. Mm-hmm. I have always said I'm neurotypical, la la la. Then I start to see all these checklists and I've looked at assessments and I've gone, you know, I'm very, unfortunately, I cut people up when I talk. I really want to get my words out and get, you know, then I always happens on things like this as well. you know, desperate to say my piece. And it's sometimes in conversations with colleagues at work or at home, my other half hates it because I'm like, no, must tell you this. And I think, God, that's a huge ADHD trait. Mm. There are traits in everyone. And I do think that at some level we are on, you know, you've got the spectrum there, you know, we might just be over here. But it does feel at times, I might get crucified for this, but it does feel at times that people are not always genuine in seeking a diagnosis.
I think that's a fair point, because terms can get overused and unfortunately then the ones that are really challenged
miss out.
So I think that's a fair assessment.
It's like saying, oh, I'm a bit OCD about that. I've said that a few times. That's really not the right thing to be saying if it's not a formal diagnosis.
Is there a danger? I've got to look at it from different angles.
Of course, yeah.
I'm working in HR. You have some people that will test things because they know it's beneficial to them. Do you think there's a danger sometimes that people will say that they're neurodiverse, but in fact they're not? Is that something that you come across with?
Yeah. It's the same as individuals saying that they're, you know.
It used to be the old bad back when I used to work in HR. I've got a bad back and it was difficult to diagnose definitively whether you had one or not.
Yeah, that is, again, essentially that is that we see a lot of that. We do see a huge amount of genuine individuals that are struggling to come to terms with why am I different? You know, why have I always been different? Or people that have actually got their diagnosis and are sobbing on the phone to us in relief because they, you know, for 40 years
they
I've been trying to understand.
Yeah.
You know, why I've just not clicked with this, you know, with people or whatever it might be. Why I've already always felt like an outsider. Huge amount of disingenuous people also seeking that because it does feel very sexy and stylish, you know, at the moment. I think just with there's like an influencer, it feels like, you know, epidemic of some kind where they're all jumping onto certain bandwagons, and that really is not fair on the individuals that are struggling. But, you know, you can look at it from two angles. You say, like, let's ignore the official label and let's actually have these direct conversations with these individuals. What do they need? What can we give you? You don't have to get that formal diagnosis to actually act and do something valuable and invest your time and whatever into that individual. You'll soon find out if people are getting caught up in their own
stories. As I describe that, every human being on that spectrum in some way, shape or form, it just leads me back to that critical leadership trait where you treat everyone as an individual, you have individual contextual discussions and you understand your staff. You know, that's so important more than ever before. You know, people don't go into work to do a job and go home anymore. They want a social safety net. They're building up relationships. The psychological contract is more, you know, important than ever before. More your domain, to be honest, Jonathan, than mine. But, you know, it's that leadership skill set to be able to navigate your staff and understand them all on an individual basis is the way I see it.
Yeah, we've seen that for a while at university where we're asked to do leadership training.
Yeah.
We're asked to train people up where they're very, very competent in their technical jobs.
Yeah.
And they've been promoted because they are good at the job, but they lack that leadership skill. Mm-hmm. And you're right, you need to get to know the team and the people that you work with so that you are able to support them individually.
I absolutely agree. And it's something I've been banging the drum on for such a long time. Because they can't have that person-to-person, that human conversation. Yeah. They can do whatever process it is with their eyes shut in their sleep and they're the absolute top dog at it.
Yeah.
But interpersonal relationships are not there. And someone once said to me about a 40-40-20 split. So 40% of leaders are the right person. They have the technical and the interpersonal skills. There are 20%. That will never be teachable, you know, in terms of those interpersonal skills. But then there's another 40% that we can get at, and we can, we as other leaders ourselves and colleagues and peers can help upskill those individuals to give them, to harness those interpersonal skills and have meaningful conversations, mm-hmm. And not run away scared, you know, straight to HR or straight to another senior colleague, you know, be able to sit and actually have a good quality conversation. And actually, you know, you don't need to go down all the OH routes and all of that if you just have a conversation straight away. And it might be a really simple thing as I'm sat in a walkway in the office and I find it really distracting and, you know, overwhelming, people walking past me. Okay, right, well, let's move you by the window or whatever that might be.
And that discreet change is done and means so much to the individual.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be, oh gosh, we need to create them an office, you know, build them an office from scratch or let them work from home, which is going to set a precedent elsewhere, you know, without having to implement and invoke all these other protocols. Just actually having a, like how we're chatting now, you know, just know your staff is really, really important.
And making them blend into the workplace. We used to work with Remploy. Remember Remploy?
Yeah.
We used to get people with learning disabilities into the workplace. And when we spoke to managers, they were so afraid of staff members and that line of banter. They were so scared of anything happening that they couldn't establish relationships. Adults with learning difficulties couldn't establish relationships in the workplace because they were protected too much and they weren't exposed to what a normal working environment was. And lots of the parents or the carers said they need to be exposed to what work is like, where there is banter, where they do get told off for not doing certain things as well.
Yeah.
So that did feel part of the organisation. And that was a massive barrier to employers employing people with learning difficulties.
So they've not been given the opportunity to not make a mistake, but just be human.
Exactly.
You know, sometimes you say the wrong thing. And that's okay. That's how you learn and develop. And again, you know, from a management perspective, it's all right to say you don't understand. You know, I've been saying that about mental health conditions for a long time. Like if you don't understand when someone said to you they've got bipolar, ask. And
you know what? I think it's one of the biggest leadership strengths. You know, I can sometimes sit in a meeting and I can see everyone nodding and I know they don't understand. And then I'll go, I don't understand. You know, it takes a big person to actually put their hands up and go, will you explain it to me? I need some help. No one's superhuman, are they?
No, exactly. And, you know, we once had someone dyscalculia. And again, I'm like, that sounds made up. What is that? I don't understand. It's a few years back. And then I'm like, oh gosh, yeah, okay, right, let's talk about this. What do you need? Let's figure it out. You know, there's no point sending it to down the OH route because they probably know as much as I do. And probably look online for references and signposting and things like that. So be honest. And work on it together because they probably don't really know either as the individual.
Yeah, for sure.
What do you think are the biggest benefits then of employing people who are neurodiverse?
Oh, absolutely. Tons, and it's always overlooked. You have got more creative thinkers, especially individuals, say, with ADHD and dyscalculia. They're looking outside of the box. You have got very analytical thinkers. So great engineering perspective. If you've got analyst roles, analyst department, IT, tech, software, absolutely crucial skill set, especially if you've got a skill gap as well in the workplace. So analytical, you've got some, I've talked about time freeze before, but there are some individuals that have incredible meticulous time management, particularly on the ASD, so the autism spectrum disorder, really by the book with that as well. So great with deadline work, project work. If you've got a whole mix of these individuals, well, you have got super.
It takes me back to the Myers-Briggs type. All those types of exercises where you get told which colour you are, and the actual beauty of a successful business is that you've got a blend of people all with a natural inclination to different characteristics and behaviours within that spectrum.
You'll find what I see and what I've read, a really good amount of leaders as well suspect they have ADHD. You know, they are problem solvers. They don't necessarily stick to the linear. They are looking here, there and everywhere for, you know, that light bulb moment. So in terms of taking a step back and thinking of a new solution to a really difficult challenge in the workplace, you've got an amazing, you know, untapped skill set there. We need to be focusing on that as opposed to what is you know, causing them detriment in the workplace.
Yeah, for sure.
And really, if you know that an individual is neurodivergent, weave that into their regular reviews. Top tip though, don't approach someone if they've never told you that they've got a neurodiversity.
Yeah.
Even if you suspect it, you can't go in there because they might never have thought of it themselves.
And for some people do not want to be categorized or have a diagnosis. They are quite happy being who they are.
Yeah. And especially if they're performing well and they are comfortable, satisfied with their life and fulfilled and are flourishing, then absolutely. Things might unravel when you start to have difficult conversations. If they are underperforming or there are capability issues or something like that, things might come from them, but they will always have to volunteer the information.
Yeah.
It's very easy to be like, I think such a body might be a bit this and that, this, and that needs to come from them.
Yeah. Most leaders are not medical practitioners.
Exactly. Very few. Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant.
Good stuff. Okay. Thanks, Kaylee.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Kaylee. It's a pleasure to welcome you onto the podcast and really interesting discussion. So thank you.
You're very
really appreciated.
Thanks, Kaylee. You can watch HR and Pat on YouTube or listen to HR and Pat on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts.